Pushkin.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's music row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Describing Bruce Springsteen as a great American singer-songwriter is a massive understatement. He's the boss. And at this point, 5 decades into his remarkable career, Bruce Springsteen is also a national treasure. His voice is unmistakable. Classic anthems like Born to Run, Hungry Heart, and Jungle Land defined the American working-class psyche in the 70s and 80s. Today, Bruce has reached rarefied air. He's sold more than 150 million albums worldwide, and he's won 20 Grammys. And at 71 years old, there's still no stopping him. He recorded his latest album, Letter to You, with the E Street Band in just 4 days. The album dives deep into the theme of loss and also includes 3 songs that Bruce wrote 50 years ago. In this interview with Malcolm Gladwell and Rick Rubin, Bruce Springsteen talks about how his Irish and Italian sides have physically manifested into songs over the years. He also describes the moment when Barack Obama gave him the idea for his intimate Broadway show, and how listening to Born to Run 45 years after it was released made Bruce realize just how good he really is.
This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond.
Here's Malcolm Gladwell, Rick Rubin, and Bruce Springsteen.
Congratulations on the new album.
Thank you, my friend.
It's really good.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Is it the first time that you recorded live with the band in this way?
We have had instances where it was not uncommon for us to get the band and track in the studio and then overdub instruments, replace instruments and over re-sing vocals. And that was a pretty common way for us to record in the 70s. And we would occasionally hit something where it was completely live. The record Darkness on the Edge of Town is completely live. Born in the USA, that one cut is completely live. But it was a bit of an exception. And so we've never had a situation where we've brought the entire band in, restricted ourselves to simply the instruments that are in the band, and then cut everything live, including the lead vocal, at one time.
Wow.
And we did 3 hours a song, 2 songs a day.
Amazing. Amazing. and both Darkness and Born to Run took a year more to record?
Yeah, they Born to Run was a good six or no, probably a year. Born in the USA was a year. Darkness on the Edge of Town was a year. They were all long records because I was searching for the record. It wasn't the recording that took a long time. It was the fact that I was searching for my album in the midst of, say, 20, 30, 40 songs and trying to find out what I had to say. So that in this case, I had basically, I think I might have one outtake from this record or something, but it's all, these were the songs that I had. They all congealed because I wrote them within about 10 days.
Wow. Is that unusual for that to happen? A big group of songs in a short period of time?
I had a record in Nebraska where I did that about 3 weeks. I had a record Tunnel of Love where I wrote most of the songs in about 3 weeks, but it's also not uncommon to spend a year and a half trying to find an album. So when the stars are aligned, those songs come in a conceptual package, and you know the gods are with you, and it doesn't take long.
Do the lyrics typically come first, or do the chords come first? Is there any rule in the way that songs come to you?
No. When I was younger, I would write the lyrics as poetry. On my first album, almost all of the lyrics came first because I had in my mind that I was that kind of a writer. And so, and the lyrics were much more dense and a lot more imagery. And that was the only record where really I would say I wrote lyrics first. Everything else, sometimes I'd start with music. Sometimes I'd have, you know, more often you have a line or if you pick the guitar up and you know, you're lucky if you get a title, if you get a good title, you're on your way. But sometimes you just pick the guitar up and it comes out of your mouth, you know. That moment is a moment that I have never heard anyone able to explain. I don't believe it's explainable, you know, and that's why it's creative. That's why it's magic. You know, you take at that moment something that is totally not physical, that is simply emotional, spiritual, somewhat intellectual, and in the air, becomes physical. It manifests itself as a physical piece of music. But what happens at that moment, I've never heard anybody describe.
Yeah, it's a miracle. It's unbelievable when you get to witness it happening. And do you experience it? I mean, when we hear your words, often we're moved to tears. When they come to you, do they hit you in that emotional way? Or do you hear them more as, these are good lyrics, this makes sense, I like the story? Do you feel it the way the listener feels it? Or is it even possible for you to know?
No, I have one leg being the creator, and I have another one that's the audience. And they're there simultaneously. And if I come up with something that's moving, I think I feel the same response, even while I'm creating it, that the audience is going to feel. You know, so you are both creator and audience simultaneously. And partially by being the audience, it's assisting you in judging the quality of what you've done.
Yeah, it's a great feeling, that feeling of, I guess that's the reason we do it.
It's the best feeling in the world. There's nothing like that moment when you go, there it is, God damn, I knew I had one more in me. You know, it's one of those moments.
And leading up to this album, how much was planned before the songs came? In other words, did the songs lead the charge, or were you thinking, I really want to make an album, it's been a while, what do you feel like?
Well, I may feel like that. I may go, my work with the E Street Band is cyclical, so I'll work on some solo projects, but I will cycle my way back around to feeling like, okay, I want to work with my band. I want to make an album of, for lack of a better word, rock music. and timing, you know, so you start to get hungry. It's like getting hungry for a steak, you know. It's like, okay, I think I'm hungry for a steak tonight, you know. And it's a similar thing. You get hungry to work with the guys. You get hungry to make a certain kind of music, to reach a certain type of audience. And it's more of an inner drive that's the first thing that you experience. And then if you're lucky, you know, you'll catch a metaphor, you'll catch a title, you'll catch a line, and songs start to lead the way.
Is there a difference between the way you write for the E Street Band and the way you do solo things?
If you take, say, my last two records, I made a record called Western Stars, and if you looked at the characters on that record, there's a very isolated sort of American persona that I wrote from. And if you judge it with this record, I'm in the middle of a community on this record. Mm-hmm. So when I work with the band, very often I'll be writing from the inside of a community outward. When I work on my own, I'm studying that sort of isolated American part of the American character. So it will, thematically, I'll move in different places.
Can you describe sort of a little more about the emotional feeling of those two modes? I mean, does writing a song in E Street mode, when you're writing inside a community, is that satisfying in a different way? Does it feel differently in the moment?
It's funny because I'm sitting there by myself, but I'm imagining this entire sort of community around me. And I'm imagining a different world than the world that I imagine when I'm writing for a solo project. It's just a different place you put your head, you know, you just travel to a different sort of emotional geography, you know, and you place yourself in that world. And you're relating to everything differently. You're relating to the people in the songs differently. And I know that eventually I'm going to actually physically be in the center of that world, which is when I'm at the center of my band and we're about to perform or about to record this music. And so it's a bit of a preparation for actually initially being in that world within the band and then going out and playing that music and being within that world within your audience. Whereas when I'm performing or writing for a solo project, I may or may not tour. I'm really character driven and writing from another part of my personality. I guess the way I would describe it is I'm writing from the Irish side of my personality, which is moodier and darker and gloomier. And when I'm writing for the band, I'm writing from the Italian side of my personality, which is hail brother, well, you know, well met, you know? Yeah. So,
to have those two sides.
It is. I was very lucky. You know, my father was very Irish in personality and my mother was totally Italian. And I sort of absorbed both of their approaches towards life. And when I became creative, I really drew on both of their sort of all of our ethnic background there.
You've talked about your dad's depression.
Yeah.
And that you have some of those seeds in you.
Oh, yeah.
And what are the things that have helped you to move through those? And when was your first experience of recognizing, oh, I have this too?
I hit a wall when I was 32 years old. I wrote Nebraska, and after Nebraska, I traveled across the country with a friend of mine. And it was on that trip that I realized something was amiss. I was always able to count on the miles, the music, to assuage whatever my demons were. But on that trip, it was the first time for some reason where it felt like it's just not doing the job. And when I got to LA, I was completely an anxious mess. And I had no idea what to do with myself next. And all I knew was I need help. I've hit the wall. I don't know where to go with this. My usual remedies that worked in my 20s, music, this, that, touring, traveling, are not working for me anymore. I've got to find another answer. and I began analysis when I was 32. I did it for 30 years.
Changed your life?
Yes, absolutely. It gave me the rest of my life, you know, the fulfillment of family, of love and being able to be loved, of delving deeper into your own history and your own essence and that affecting your creativity. It gave me another, the way that I would describe it is you sort of, you're standing in front of a brick wall and you think you're seeing all that the world is. And then suddenly you start pushing and suddenly a brick drops out and you look through into this complete other experience and existence and you go, fuck, you know, whoa, I've been living on such a limited level. And it just expands your, you know, expanded my vision. It also helped, it helped rid me of my depression. That and also pharmacology has played a big part in giving me my life back. And that's been very important also.
It affect your writing, I imagine?
No, I have never noticed that my depression ever affected my writing or that any medications I've ever taken affected my writing. When I was deeply, deeply, deeply depressed, I could always still work and write. For some reason, it never affected that part of my creative life or personality.
I'm almost asking the other way around. Like, do you look at the songs you wrote pre-therapy as written by a smaller aspect of who you are, and that through therapy, you've expanded your vision? I don't know if that's, I'm leading, that's a leading question.
Yeah, it is. And I can tell you that, no, I don't. Because I look back and the 45th anniversary of Born to Run was about a week or two ago. And so I was with a buddy of mine. And I said, hey, I'm going to do an anniversary cruise and play Born to Run start to finish. And we said, okay. So Sunday morning, we got in the car, put it on. And I realized that's one of the best records I ever made.
Beautiful.
You know, yeah, if I listen to Nebraska, I go, that's one of the best records I ever made. So the dealing with my own personal depression, the material I wrote previous to that really was unscathed and untouched and it did not limit the scope of my writing in any way, in any real way. I look back and say some of my best records were pre-analysis and post-analysis.
Has music inspired your writing more than anything else, or has literature played a role in lyrics and song structure for you?
Everything I learned musically, I probably learned between 1965 and 1968, between when I was 15 and 18. I was a student, an astute student of Top 40 radio, where the masters of songwriting and record making were existed at that moment in time. I studied that like it was for my master's degree. And I would say that maybe into the early 70s, but shortly thereafter, I stopped looking towards music for specific information. And I began in the late 70s to get more inspiration from reading a lot of film, a lot of noir, James M. Cain, Flannery O'Connor, Jim Thompson, and from watching films, John Ford and Howard Hawks, and a lot of film noir. So I began to get a lot more inspiration from literature and film the older that I got.
Just talk a little bit about this album. Many things fascinating about it, but one was that you include a number of songs from way back when.
Yeah.
First of all, what was behind that decision? Start with that. Why did you want to put these, particularly If I Was the Priest?
As most creative things, it's a non-decision. I don't operate from deciding first. I operate from an internal hunger, and my decisions come from there. So in this case, I happened to record a song that's on the record called Janie Needs a Shooter, and I recorded it. I said, I'm going to record this for Record Day in the United States. You put one song out. But I recorded it with the band, the way that we cut Darkness on the Edge of Town, and it sounded like Darkness on the Edge of Town. And I said, wow, that's how the band really sounds when we play live. And I haven't caught that in the studio in a long time. And so I'm going to keep this for some future album. And so having one song that was 45 years old, I then was working on a box set of outtakes, the first of which was an entire album of songs I cut for John Hammond when he asked me to make a demo. He produced a demo for me when I first went to Columbia. These songs were amongst those songs. And I said, well, a couple of these might be fun for the band to play. So it just kind of fell into place. And when we played them, they were a lot of fun to play. And the band came up with great arrangements for them. And that's how they ended up on the record.
Why didn't these songs make it onto earlier records? Just by chance or?
No, it's like, you know, you're so fickle as an artist. You're so fickle, you know, you have this music and then you write something new and boom, you forget about that and you're on to the next thing. By the time I had a chance to record my first album, I'd already made an album but I put that one aside because I had new music and I wanted to put what I had newest out. And so there was an album that was pre-Greetings from Asbury Park that was all of this acoustic music with this type of lyric writing, and more than an album, almost two albums and an album and a half that never got released.
Mm-hmm. How does it feel to, for the first time, release a song that you wrote 45 years ago?
Yeah, the two songs, If I Were the Priest and Song for Orphans, are 50 years old.
50 years
and,
old.
And it felt like I wrote them yesterday, except I wouldn't write in that style now. You know, that very verbose, heavy amount of images. I just don't write that way anymore. I write more colloquially. And so it was kind of fun to wrap my head around, you know, singing all those words again. I realized, gee, this was really a great part of my writing life, and I kind of left it too soon because of the new Dylan comparisons. I got sensitive about it, and I put it away a little too soon because really I kind of had my own style of writing in that style. And looking back, I said, I wouldn't have mind making another record or two in that style, but I was very sensitive to, I was young, sensitive to about creating my own identity, and so I left that style of writing behind rather quickly. You hear it on the first three albums and you hear it less each album, you know. Mm. And by the time I get the Darkness, I'm done with it.
There's still time to make those albums, you know.
I know. I got all the materials sitting there. I may do that.
So you played If I Was a Priest for Hammond. You were auditioning for Hammond.
Yes.
One of the most legendary figures in rock and roll history. Could you take us back to that moment? Were you scared?
I was on the elevator going up to what might have been the 30th floor in Black Rock, which was with my manager. And John Hammond, to give you an idea what the record business was like, was seeing nobodies who he did not know at all off the streets of New York City, who simply talked their way through his secretary. Mike Appel was very good at that, and he did it. So here we've got a 30-minute audition with John Hammond. We go up. On the way up, I'm going, well, it's like this. I have nothing. When I come back, I'm not going to have any less than I have right now. So I'm trying to talk myself into not being nervous. It almost worked, but not quite.
What else did you play for him? Do you remember?
I played If I Were the Priest. The first song I played for him was It's Hard to Be a Saint in the City, which ended up on my first record. And I believe I played a song for him called Growing Up. I only played about three songs. And after I played one song, and he said, you got to be on Columbia Records.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
It was that sudden. Yeah. He didn't wait to hear the second one. I played the first. He said, you got to be on Columbia Records.
Wow.
I said, okay.
We always invite the people we interview on Broken Record to play little bits of songs if they want to. I would love, I'd love to hear a piece of whatever you want, but I was going to suggest, if I was a priest, can we recreate the John Hammond audition here?
Oh man, I don't know. I don't know if I even know those words. I know because there's a
yeah. Wait, John Hammond apparently said the minute he heard that song, he knew you were a Catholic.
Oh yeah, yeah. He was really excited about it. That's what he loved. He loved the screwed up Catholicism in it.
Wait, was he Catholic?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't think so.
It's funny that he could spot it right away.
Yeah.
But you're a double cat. Like, you're a special breed with Italian one side, Irish on the other. You're like the most powerful kind of Catholic hybrid.
Yeah, we're steeped in it. So it's my lot in life.
We'll be back with Bruce Springsteen after a quick break.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
We're back with Rick Rubin, Malcolm Gladwell, and Bruce Springsteen.
How is your spiritual life now? What's your spiritual life like?
I don't think about it very much. I guess if I look at it, I'd say it comes through in my music, you know, and then in just the general, your general behavior during the day, and what you see reflected in your children as to how well you've done and how well you've lived over the years, you know. I got some solid citizens that we've raised and makes Patty and I proud, and they got good inner, their inner core is strong and righteous. And so we go, well, we must have done something right, you know. We had no dogma or religion, but we just had a way of living that I hope passed on a little bit of righteousness for them. And so if I observe it in any way, it's purely through listening and looking back at my songs and seeing where they were influenced by my Catholic faith and or by a spirituality in general. I basically consider myself a spiritual songwriter in that primarily I want you to dance, I want to entertain you, I want you to listen to my music and wash your clothes and vacuum your floor, and I'm also trying to address your soul. So
beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And this album, I mean, there's a powerful theme of loss in this album. You talk, I mean, you have lost a lot of people close to you over the last few years.
Well, you know, death is funny because when you're Italian and Irish, you get very used to death when you're very young because of the wakes. You know, I was to many wakes when I was 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, where the body is just in the room for days at a time and people are drinking and laughing and visiting and everyone's excited to be together. And I went through a lot of that as a child. And then you leave home, you reach your 20s, and for a long time, unless there's something unusually tragic, death is not a big part of your life, 20s, 30s, even 40s. But once you get into your 50s, 60s, and 70s, it rears its head again, and people begin to die from natural causes and from illnesses, and it becomes once again a part of your life. And so it's become a natural part of my writing life also. Mm-hmm.
Is there a song? Do you have a favorite on this album?
I like House of a Thousand Guitars is one of my favorites.
How do you choose a favorite song? Like, what is it that, what are the criteria that in your own mind makes something a song special?
I knew when I was writing it, I knew that there was just something to it that spoke to me, you know? And while I was writing, I said, oh, that's a great title. Yeah, I just said House of a Thousand Guitars is a great title. If I can write a song and make that title work, I'm good, you know? So I got very excited about it and finished the song, you know? It addresses the world that I've attempted to create with my fans and audience and amongst my band and just the world at large, you know? And so it was... It's just one of my favorite songs on the record.
Mm-hmm. Has your relationship to any of the songs changed over time? Like you said, you did a listen to Born to Run recently for the 45th anniversary. Yeah. And when you listen back, I know you liked it. Did anything strike you as surprising, or did any of the meanings change? What was the experience like?
The experience was like, damn, I was good when I was 24 years old. You know, there was like, and sort of being surprised. One thing I was surprised at is how well it was recorded. It really, when I played it back, it sounded quite modern. And then I was a little shocked at the depth and detail of the music that I was writing at that age. Because I didn't really play that well. I mean, I had a little Aeolian spinet piano that was half out of tune, and I wrote all of those introductions to Jungle Land, to Back Streets, Meeting Across the River. Born to Run was written largely on piano, which is why Roy Bittan plays such a stellar role on the record, because I wrote most of the songs on the piano. And so I think I went back, and it was just fun to realize, wow, I was really my musical tastes and abilities were quite sophisticated for when I was so young, because I probably wrote most of Born to Run when I was just 24, and we recorded it and released it when I was 25.
And you play those songs, you play many of those songs live over the years, but you probably don't have much opportunity or reason to go back and listen to the album.
No, I didn't listen to the record. I think I listened to it on its 40th anniversary, but before that, probably not in 20 years.
Was there any moment in listening to it where you were taken aback, where you heard something that you don't remember was there, or something that took you by surprise?
No, I think it was just when I listened to it in its entirety, how complete and full it was, and how well conceived it was, given how young I was, you know. If I hear one of the cuts, I go, yeah, it's pretty good. But if I hear the album in its entirety, I go, it's a little better than that.
Do you ever realize anything about yourself looking back on the songs?
Yeah, your songs are generally out in front of your personal development. They're like a divining rod, you know. When what you write about is something you sort of, the self-realization can come a year or 6 months or 2 years. Oh, fuck. Look, I knew this back 2 years ago, but I it was in this song. And I didn't really realize it about myself, you know, for that period of time. So your inner life, your subconscious, tends to be out in front of your self-awareness, which is pretty much the same with everybody. In my case, I record it. I actually record that subconscious and then have a chance to go back and literally look at it and realize that it took me a while to get there personally.
Would you say most songs start from the subconscious and then work their way up, or do some songs just start intellectually for you?
Anything that starts intellectually usually sucks. you know, I almost always depend on some inner life sending a message to my brain to get active and to employ the mechanics that I've learned over and the craft I've learned over the years. But it always comes out of the heart and soul first. So that's generally the process of my writing.
Have you ever kept a dream journal?
I never kept a journal, but I'm an active and dreamer, and I dream and remember what I dream easily four nights a week or so, you know. Always been a very active dreamer. And the only time I kept a bit of a journal was when I was doing some dream work with my therapist.
Would you say that a song comes up like a dream comes up? Is there a relationship?
No. I all the years that I've followed my dreams, I've written one song out of a dream that was worth anything. And it's just a little sleeper on a record called Working on a Dream, as a matter of fact, called Surprise, Surprise. It's a nice little song. And I actually came up with it. Usually when you're dreaming, if you write something, you think it's phenomenal, and then you wake up and you actually play it and it's not very good at all. You know, the dream enhances your experience of it. It was literally just one song where it paid off in the end.
How much of who you are came from what you've learned versus inborn?
That's probably a 50-50, I'd say, you know, nurture, nature. I would say that you come out with a certain personality, and that personality infects everything you do, your behavior, and what you create for the rest of your life. Then you learn your craft, and you process who you are through your craft and through the mechanics of what you've learned. But I think the essence of who you are is with you at birth. I think it can be distorted. You can irreparably harm that person, and you can do great destruction to it, and in which case your life will take different paths. But if it's even remotely nurtured, I believe that it's such a strong force that it's going to push through, and you're going to find some expression for it in some form as your life goes by, you know. But I kind of go half and half with that, because I got into, say, a lot of noir writing and film noir, and there you get Nebraska and Ghost of Tom Joad and Devils and Dust, where I write a lot of noir stories in my narrative writing and the kind of narrative writing that I do. So that comes from just what I was attracted to, but also then I'd have to say, but that really came out of the Irish part of my personality that I was given from my father. So you can trace it immediately back to your birth also.
What was the music playing around your house when you were growing up?
No music.
Really?
No music, no music, no books, no films.
Wow.
It was strictly television and Top 40 radio.
When did you first start playing piano?
I was really young. My aunt had a piano in her foyer, and we would visit my Italian grandmother, who lived to be 100 years old, every Sunday. And so when my mother was upstairs with her mother, because they only spoke Italian, I was downstairs in the foyer tinkling around on my aunt's piano. And I started to make some noise out of it. And so she said, here, I'm going to give you a key to the house. And when you leave school, if you want, you can come into the house and play the piano. And so I started to come home from school and I go to my aunt's house. Nobody was there. And I would just start practicing the piano. I was in my teens and I became a relatively proficient accompanist, you know, nothing special, but I can accompany myself relatively well.
You said you wrote the songs for Born to Run on the piano. Is that typical for you, or is that unusual to write a whole album on piano?
I haven't done it in a long time. This record, Letter to You, was primarily on guitar. Back in that time, I wrote Racing in the Street. A song called Racing in the Street was on piano. That was a bit of a unique record in that I wrote a lot of. But if you go back and hear all the musical introductions and things, you'll see how it was piano based.
How many songs have you written that you haven't released?
Oh, at least 100.
Wow.
You know, and we already put out a 70 box set of stuff from the vault, you know, 10 years ago, but I still have tons of stuff left.
Are you writing all the time?
No, I write very rarely. I didn't write a rock song in 7 years before I wrote this batch in 10 days. So I write when the writing is there and when I'm sort of inspired, and I don't worry about not writing.
You never had that kind of crisis moment, panic moment, when you think the well is dry?
Of course, you have that all the time.
But you said you never worry about not writing. You manage your anxiety well, is that it?
Yeah, I have that all the time, and I'm used to that feeling.
Yeah.
You know, so in a sense, when I feel like that, and you always feel like that after you've written a good song, you go, oh, I hope that's not the last one, you know. But I've kind of gotten used to that being part of the natural state of a writer's consciousness, mm-hmm. You know, in that it's such a magic trick, and you are it's so out of your control, even after all the craft that you've learned, that you know, you just don't know how you do it. And so you know, I can sit here and say, gee, I'd like to write another album, you know, but I know it'll come along at some point. I don't know how or when. So I'm both, I guess the best way to explain it was I'm comfortable with the anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Does it usually come with one song? Is that how it starts? If you haven't written for a while, will a song come?
It'll come with a song. And if it's a good song, and if it's working around a theme you haven't worked before, like what I did on this record, I took as my subject music itself and rock and roll itself as an idea, and the ideas of bands themselves as an idea. And I've never written about that subject before. So when I locked onto that first thing, I realized there was a small but deep well of other songs that I had and things I had to say about that idea, and about the passing of time and losing band members and losing old friends and what it's like at this age to be doing in my line of work. So, yeah, if you're lucky, you know, you'll lock onto something and you'll tap a little vein and more than one song will come out.
Did the subject matter come before the first song, or did the song come and give you the subject matter?
The circumstances came before the song. I had a very close friend who passed away, who was the last, besides me, was the last member of my first band. So that left me as the only surviving member. And I thought about that a lot. I didn't think about it in the sense, okay, now I'm going to write some music about this. But I thought about it a lot, and then a song came out. You know, strange things happen. I had a kid give me a guitar outside of the Broadway theater, and an Italian kid was standing there one night, and he had a guitar in his hand, and I thought he wanted me to sign it. So they said, no, Bruce, this is for you. We had it made for you. And I took it, and on the way home, I looked at it, and it was made from beautiful wood. It played gorgeously and sounded wonderful, and I left it in my living room, and that was the guitar that most of the songs came out of. So, you know, it was another bit of lucky happenstance, you know.
Would you say most of the albums had a triggering moment, like either some life experience that starts the first song that leads to the journey of the album?
Yeah, I would say that perhaps, you know, but also it's sort of like you start your car and it runs. Oh, great, an album comes out. You start your car, it runs for a half an hour, breaks down, doesn't run for 2 weeks, start it again, nothing again, nothing. Records are made like that. You know, I've written a song, I've written six songs that I think are really record worthy, and then spent a year trying to write six more.
Wow.
You know, so it's simply not predictable, and you have to get used to withstanding that anxiety, and you have to get comfortable with it. Because born in the USA, I think I wrote eight or nine of those songs, and then spent a year waiting for Dancing in the Dark, Bobby Jean, and No Surrender. And
wow,
that was just the way it went. I didn't have an album till I had that music, even if I had nine good songs sitting there.
We'll be back with more from Bruce Springsteen after a quick break.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented three new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
We're back with the rest of Rick Rubin and Malcolm Gladwell's conversation with Bruce Springsteen.
How many people were in the original E Street Band?
The original E Street Band was a five-piece band. There was one keyboard, and then I played keyboard sometimes. There was a keyboard, a guitar player, a bass player, a drummer, and a saxophonist. It was a little club rock and soul band.
And when did it start expanding? The last time I saw you play, I think it felt like there were more people on stage than I could count. The last time I saw it.
We might have carried horns and singers on that tour. Generally, the band, the stable membership of the band is myself, Steve Van Zandt on the guitar, Nils Lofgren on the guitar, Gary Talon on the bass, Max Weinberg on the drums, Charlie Giordano on the organ, Roy Bittan on the piano, and Jake Clemens on the saxophone. I think that's 9 people. And that's the hardcore of the E Street Band now.
Do you recall what was going on the first time you decided not to make an album with the E Street Band?
Let me think. That would have been Nebraska, I guess. And I was planning to make Nebraska with the E Street Band. But what I ended up with came about as being such an accident. I ended up with a cassette that I had in my back pocket that I carried around for several months while trying to re-record that music with the E Street Band in the studio. And everything we recorded sounded too slick. It sounded too bright, you know, and I lost all the mystery that came out of the happy accidents that occurred in my little bedroom. So eventually, after trying for quite a while, I just pulled the tape out and said, this is it. This is the record. It's either going to come out on cassette or on vinyl. And that's the way it was. And then after that, solo records came up just to get some relief from working with the band initially. The next solo record I made was Tunnel of Love, which I made in my garage with me and another guy, and I played all the instruments. But it was just a relief to sort of get away from the pressure of having to record with the band and having to just use these particular musicians, this set of instrumentation. I needed to have more freedom than that, and so it just came around very naturally.
Is Nebraska the only album that you ever made that you didn't know you were making the album while you were making it?
Yeah. I've made other. There's a record called Devils and Dust that. But no, I knew I was recording for something then. But Nebraska was really where I was just trying to make a demo to see if the songs were any good, and I ended up making an album.
Amazing.
I remember as a fan of yours, the album that took me by surprise was Nebraska. Because it was the first time I had seen the Irish side of you,
yeah.
And the adoption of this quintessentially American. I mean, I thought of you as, you know, ethnic New Jersey immigrant kind of America, and then all of a sudden you were playing a Heartland character.
Yeah,
and that took me by. I mean, I was blown away by the album, but it took me by surprise. And I'm curious: did it take lots of people by surprise? Did you? Was that a In retrospect, was Nebraska a hugely important kind of transition album?
It was for me because I studied a whole, I came upon a whole type of writing that really began on the River album with The River and with a song called Stolen Car. There was a narrative type of writing, a storytelling type of writing that maybe you would go back to Woody Guthrie or Talking Blues or, but basically, It was inspired by books and cinema that I was interested in at that moment, and also of creating a character that was wider than just the character that came out of New Jersey, that was just a broader American voice. I was interested in at that time. So yeah, the record came out. People didn't know what to make of it. It got a little bit of airplay. It got a lot of nice reviews. And I didn't tour on it, and it disappeared rather shortly.
I'm very surprised to hear you say it disappeared, because I feel like it's one of the records that has had the greatest long-term.
Yeah, I'm just me sort of commercially, you know.
I see. Yeah.
But it has had, if I meet young people, a lot of young people, that's their record for one reason or another. Maybe because it came up shortly after the punk revolution, and I've seen it described as one of the first punk acoustic albums, you know? So
like
it sort of is in a funny way in that it was completely done at home, do it yourself, cost $1,000, little 4-track tape player mixed onto a beatbox through a Gibson guitar Echoplex that was running slow. And just this mysterious creation came out of it, you know?
Do you think that the kinds of people who were attracted to that record and to the subsequent Irish side, if you want to use that paradigm,
okay,
are different kind of fan for that music than you are for the other kinds of music?
Yeah. When I play, I have a lot of different types of audiences, you know, and I believe I have an audience that's probably interested in that side of what I do, and maybe a little less of the electric side of what I do. though I think I have an audience that pretty much follows me through both iterations of my creative life. But I'm very conscious at night when we come out in the stadium or in an arena of the fact that I'm playing to casual listeners, I'm playing to hardcore listeners, and so I try to build a show that sort of addresses those things, you know. But I have to be aware that I'm playing to a lot of different audiences at once.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what the first song you wrote for Nebraska was?
I believe it was Nebraska itself.
This is an aside, but I love Nebraska so completely, and it was my moment when I came for the Italian and stayed for the Irishman. But with Nebraska, the Frankie and Johnny song redeems the whole album.
Oh.
It was always the one that stuck in my head because it's the one where the guy does the morally right thing. Man man gives up on his family, he ain't no good, whatever that line is.
Yeah.
The rest is about these people who have somehow kind of fallen away and then in the middle of it you have the sheriff who understands that his connection to his brother is more important than his badge. And it's just I just thought that was suddenly this ray of sunshine comes through in that, and it just put that album on a different level for me.
Well, the whole record is about a fallen world, you know, that we all have to live in. That song, you're right, there's a little bit of redemption in it. And it's one of my favorite songs on the record, Highway Patrolman.
Highway Patrolman. More than a little bit. Wait, Bruce, more than a little bit. A lot of it is... There's a whole lot of redemption. That's Jesus on the cross in that album. That's like...
yeah. I hear you.
On the subject of Catholicism, since we're sort of dancing around it, you said in a conversation with Martin Scorsese last year, you were talking about how much of your work is informed by having gone to Catholic school.
Oh, yeah.
And then we have that John Hammond comment about, I knew you were a Catholic. Can you put your finger on what is the Catholic part of your music?
Well, you know, I guess if I look back, it was great fear of a spiritual darkness is impressed upon you when you're very, very young. That's one thing. Perhaps the ability to work towards a spiritual light is also impressed upon you. So those are very high stakes. Mm-hmm. And if you live your life with those stakes on the table, it'll be an interesting experience, you know? And that may be at the center of what my Catholic upbringing does for my music and perhaps for me also, you know? That might explain some of it.
I was gonna ask Bruce if you wanted to play another song off this latest album and give us a little bit of the backstory.
Okay, let me see what I can find here. This was the song that kicked off the writing for the entire record because it was most directly about my friend George who passed away and about that particular time in my playing life. Everything came out of that song.
Beautiful.
All the rest of the songs came out of the world that I began to create in that song.
You talked earlier about writing for the band, and you imagine the song in your head before you record it with the band. Is the mission to get it to sound like what you hear in your head, or are you sometimes surprised by what the band contributes in the process of making the record?
Well, I try to get it to sound like I hear it in my head, but I don't limit it to what I'm hearing in my head. Usually, you don't get it to sound like you hear it in your head. You know, it's sort of a guide, you know. But when it works, as it worked on this record, all I knew is like, yeah, these are rock songs. I want them to sound kind of glorious. And and so when the band came in and performed them, this was a case where I got more out of, you know, I have a good producer. We have good recording technique right now. And the sound of the record is really quite lovely. And so I got a little more out of it than I might have been imagining when I came in. And that's always a sweet surprise. I think it's the best record I've made with my band in a very long time, you know. So I'm very, very excited about it, and I can't wait to get out in one of these days and actually play it for my fans.
Once, knock on wood, COVID passes, it will be how many years since you and the band have been touring?
I believe we haven't toured now in 2, going on 3. So I think the last time we toured was 2017, perhaps, you know, counting our lucky stars. I'm looking towards 2022. I can't imagine there's really going to be anything going on this next year. And I'm hoping, if things work out, ideally 2022 would be the earliest that you could expect people are going to feel comfortable going shoulder to shoulder again anywhere.
Yeah. And you've never gotten tired of touring.
No, I love to travel. I like staying in hotels. I like being in strange and different towns. I still like it as much as I did when I was young, though I'm very happy now to actually have a real home to come back to.
Yeah.
Beautiful. You mentioned in the, I think it was in the Broadway piece, you talked about blank pages and the feeling of having nothing when you were young, the sense of not having anything to do and feeling this freedom going forward,
yeah.
Even though there was nothing really to look forward to, but you just had a sense of freedom.
Sure.
Do you ever want to re-embrace with that and stop working and create a new blank page and imagine a life of just whatever that would be, freedom?
I would have to ruin my entire existence to do that, which I'm sort of not exactly willing to do at this late date, you know. But I still have that sense of my life makes room for those blank pages within a certain set of limitations, and that satisfies me. You know, that this whole album and experience with the band was an entirely blank page that we got to fill from absolutely nothing. So I'm satisfied with that.
This is kind of a personal question. I love the Broadway show. I really love the Broadway show. And I want to talk about how that came about, what gave you the idea. But the personal part of it is you talk a lot about being a con man of sorts or a phony. You start the show that way. And you talk about how the songs are not necessarily representative of your life, but more maybe of your dad or of things that you've seen, your situation growing up. With the stories, the new stories that you told in the play, are they all really your experiences or are those also embellished?
Well, I would say that I have a funny job in that when you write and sing something, And you do it really well, it's so credible that people simply believe it's you. 90% of the time, there is an emotional truth, a spiritual truth that you have to draw up from inside of your essence for that piece of work to be credible. But how you said it, the incidences, the details, the story itself can be something, a complete work of imagination, you know? So you have to be able to draw on your own inner truth, but at the same time, you can dress it up in any monkey suit that you want. And I often do, you know? And so writing is largely an act of the imagination, but which is where you get your geography, your detail of character. But for that character and geography to come to life into a real breathing world, you have got to tap into your own true inner life. So when you're doing both of those things, you're writing well.
Beautiful, beautiful. So tell me about how the Broadway show came about.
Broadway show came about by accident. I was invited to the White House by Barack Obama to perform in his last 2 weeks that he was at the White House. And so I said, I don't want to bring the band. It's too big a hassle. I'll play some acoustic songs. And then I said, well, what am I going to do? I'll read from my book and I'll play some acoustic songs. And so I came into the studio here and I spent about 2 hours picking out segments of the book and then a song to go with it. then I realized I had to slightly rewrite the book so it sounded colloquial. Prose writing and speaking are not the same thing. So I rewrote the pieces a little bit so it sounded just like I was speaking off the top of my head. I went and I performed it at the White House, about 90 minutes of the play, which I put together in about 4 hours here in this studio. Wow. And at the end of the play, Barack Obama got on, the president got on stage and he says, "Hey, I know you did that just for us, but that should be a show." You know. And so on the way back from Washington, I was with my manager, John Landau, and my wife, Patty. And we said, "Yeah, that should be a show." So, well, but and we started talking about a venue. And I realized if it was going to be a show, I played to 200 people in the East Room. But if it was going to be a show, I needed a very small audience that was very controllable, or I could get an enormous amount of cooperation and silence. And it had to be a very intimate environment. And those jewel box theaters are on Broadway. So that's how I ended up there.
Was it a fun experience?
Best experience of my life. One of the greatest.
Wow. Wow. Was it difficult doing the same material day after day?
I loved it because I always, first of all, it was a world that I loved entering. It really got me in touch with my past, and it was sort of summational. I sort of, this is a little bit of what I've learned up to now. And I enjoyed inhabiting those characters every night. And I found something in it every night. And right up to the very last night, I was having the time of my life.
Were the audiences consistently reacting in the same spots, or might, depending on the night, did different things move people differently?
Yeah, the audiences would vary night to night. You know, some nights a little rowdier, some nights, you know, a little more expressive, other nights listening a little deeper. There was a general level of consistency that I found comforting and good to play to. But I've never played to two audiences that are alike, not on any night of my work life. I've never seen two audiences that are the same or where the alchemy is the same two nights in a row. It's impossible to happen.
Did you feel more of a sense of direct communication with the audience than you would in a concert setup?
No, not necessarily. The mechanics are very, very different. But you still have to connect your mind. You have to meet mind to mind and heart to heart and soul to soul, whether you're at a giant stadium or whether you're in a 900-seat theater on Broadway. The mechanics of connection are the same. You've got to draw on your emotional life, your spiritual life, your intellectual self, your physical self when you play with the band. And, you know, you've just got to meet that audience face to face as intensely as you can. So even though the situations are very different, the fundamental act is very similar.
I'm so happy that you made it.
Thank you.
I really
am.
It's like it feels good.
Thank you.
What's your favorite and least favorite part of your job?
I suppose the least favorite would be the prying into your private life, which I don't experience much anymore because I'm pretty much old, and people are and people are a lot less interested in you, you know. But when I was younger, I that could really raise the level of my anxiety, and I resented that a little bit. But I learned to live with it because that's as they say in The Godfather, this is the life we've chosen. And so that would be my least favorite. My most favorite is simply getting on stage and playing. That's having that moment with the audience and with my band on Broadway with the in a situation like that. That's the thing I love to do best.
Beautiful.
Well, how'd we do, guys?
I think we did great.
Can't tell you how much fun this has been and an honor.
Great, man. I'm a fan of both you guys, and I had a great time doing it.
Thanks to The Boss for taking us deep into his writing process and for playing some music. You can hear his new album, Letter to You, along with all of our favorite Springsteen songs on my playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. And be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast. There you can find extended cuts of new and old episodes. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Martin Gonzalez, Eric Sandler, and is executive produced by Mia Lobel. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. And if you like Broken Record, please remember to share, rate, and review our show on your podcast app. I'm Justin Richmond. Peace.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at marketmessage2024.com right now. Again, the link to watch is marketmessage2024.com. That's marketmessage2024.com. Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.